Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody, for coming along on this dreadful day. This is the view that I'm interested in challenging today. I'm calling it the conventional view, but it is basically a series of propositions about, or that inform our existing approaches to a number of problems in animal ethics theory, but also animal welfare science, and indeed public policy and the development of legislation for our dealings with animals. I'm calling it the conventional view, and it's made up of a number of propositions, but the most important ones are the idea that is the idea that pain and death can be separated. They're two separate issues. So causing pain to a creature is seen as one particular issue that's seen as a serious issue, but taking the life of the creature, so long as it's painless, is not seen as such a big deal. The idea is that there is something about animals' mental states that make killing them not such an important or serious matter. This is a capacities-based view. What matters is the capacities of the animal. So if we want to discover which species are harmed by death or harmed by confinement, we simply have to find the species that have particular mental states, and that's the end of the question. Right? So the idea that death and confinement constitutes harm is approached as a scientific kind of a question. You just have to find the creatures with the particular mental states, and they're the ones that are harmed. So pain and death are pulled apart. The view that I'm putting forward is that, in fact, pain and death ought not to be seen as distinct issues. In fact, they're closely related. I guess the basic rhetorical idea is if we're concerned about pain, then this suggests we're also concerned about the life of the creature and how the creature is treated. But there's three substantive things that I'm doing in this paper. One is I'm extending a thesis about why pain is bad to animals. I'm making a claim about what happens when people use particular moral terms. And then I'm adding to a kind of a burgeoning literature in my field, extending kind of moral sentiments theory to animals. I'm making a claim about that as well. But the basic idea I want to get across is that if we're concerned about how pain feels, then this says something about the life of the creature as well. So I have a paper to read, but I'll be pausing a little bit along the way, I think, as well. All right. The conventional view in animal ethics theory, no less than animal welfare science, is that causing an animal pain and painlessly taking its life are two separate issues, warranting very different ethical evaluation. While causing pain is regarded as a very serious matter, painless killing is held as an issue of little direct significance. Even some avowedly pro-animal philosophers, such as Peter Singer, who argue that an animal's interest in avoiding pain ought to be given the same moral weight as a human person's, claim that there is no serious ethical obstacle to painlessly killing animals. An important presupposition of the conventional view is the principle that the harm of death ought to be determined largely on the basis of what animals are like, that is, with reference to their psychological capacities. In line with this principle, the capacities possessed by the animals themselves are regarded as the major consideration when developing theory and policy responses to the problem of killing animals. Accordingly, in line with the orthodox view in cognitive pathology and the philosophy of mind, as animals do not possess the kind of forward-looking mental states that would make death a deprivation in the relevant sense, advocates of the conventional view hold that painlessly killing them is not against their interests. Indeed, painless killing is often held up as an appropriate means of bringing about pain relief. But is the conventional separation of pain and death sustainable? Should the problem of killing animals be approached as an essentially descriptive question, as if satisfactory answers could be found once and for all with a tape measure or perhaps under a microscope? In what follows, I will argue that common sense concern for animals, a concern supposedly manifest in existing animal protection institutions, that is, animal welfare and anti-cruelty legislation and norms, points to the issues of pain and death being more closely connected than is ordinarily assumed. It is appropriate, in my view, to allow for so-called laypeople's concern for animals to inform debate about the harm of death, because the issue bears so importantly upon the problem of killing animals, which I take as a distinctly evaluative, or at least a non-scientific problem, a political or an evaluative problem. But in saying that killing animals is an evaluative problem, I do not mean to suggest that scientific evidence for animal mental states is not important at all for addressing the harm of death. It is just that such considerations need not be seen as decisive, but could instead just constitute one set of considerations among others. Drawing upon a thesis about the badness of pain, I want to suggest that implicit in everyday concern for animal pain is recognition that the lives of animals are likewise the appropriate object of moral concern. If a creature's pain matters, then its life matters. That's the basic idea. Now, thinking about concern for pain in this way changes the rationale and broadens the implications of existing pain-focused animal welfare and anti-cruelty legislation and norms. It enables us to view such institutions as having a deliberative dimension that is reflective of a public concern for animals that extends beyond concern for felt pain to a concern for a range of non-phenomenological considerations, including the life of the sufferer. The explicit institutional objective to ensure animal lives are pain-free could be read as an implicit endorsement of the view that their lives also matter, or at least that they are not simply disposable. The aim then is to stimulate discussion about how we determine an animal's interest in continuing to live. Should we give more credence to ordinary valuing practices, that is, what people care about, what they say about animals, what they imagine animals to be like, rather than approach the issue in orthodox fashion, strictly with reference to empirical evidence for particular mental states. Okay, so that's the view that I'm trying to challenge, this idea that thinking about pain is a scientific question, and that when we're talking about animals, all that's relevant is how it feels on the inside, that is, phenomenological considerations. So what we're going to do now is think about why pain is a bad thing. Since at least the 18th century, a widespread view in ethical theory is that sentience, the capacity to experience pleasure and pain, is a sound basis for attributing moral importance to an individual. The possession of sentience, it is argued, entitles an individual to particular moral goods, usually in the form of rights, understood as protection from certain deprivations and inflictions. Deprivations and inflictions are regarded as morally salient because proponents of the sentience view, precisely because of how they register in the consciousness of the individual. They are experienced as aversive, unpleasant, and painful, and to this extent it is presupposed they are unwanted. It is thus the phenomenological dimension of pain, how it feels on the inside, so to speak, that is regarded as its morally significant dimension. But an important implication of the capacity to feel pain has been passed over by proponents of the sentience view. In their rush to ensure that ethical theory addresses the undeniable badness of the phenomenology of pain, sentience theorists unnecessarily restrict the ethical implications of sentience to experiential aspects of pain and suffering. But is the fact that the unpleasantness of feeling pain is uppermost in our minds when we think about why pain is bad, or why it is good to lead a life as much as possible pain-free, a good enough reason for thinking that all that matters about pain is how it feels? Perhaps instead pain has other, broader implications that any credible ethical theory needs to take account of. By way of exploring this possibility, think about the last time you took an aspirin to relieve a headache. Presumably, you wanted to get rid of the pain, not simply because you have an in-principle objection to unpleasant feelings. No one is just anti-pain. Rather, you took the aspirin because the pain is bad for you in some respects. Which respects exactly? Obviously, the phenomenology of a headache is unpleasant and you want it to go away. So how pain feels is one bad aspect. But is that all that can be said for taking the painkiller? What if it was the case that after the unpleasant phenomenology went away, you still had to remain in bed all day as if you were in grips of one of your regular migraines? Wouldn't we say in such a case that the painkiller did not work properly and that you are still being impacted by the pain? Doesn't it also suggest that the upside of pain relief is that not only that bad feelings go away, but also that you can get on with your life pain-free? So the badness of pain seems to be twofold. It is bad because of how it feels on the inside, but it is also bad because it interferes with something that we ordinarily consider is worth being pain-free. A day free of pain is a better day for us than a day in which we have a headache. But to say it is good for an individual to have a pain-free day, or better still, a pain-free life, is to imply that something valuable is being undermined and subsequently lost by the occurrence of unpleasant experiences. It is to suggest that pain blights or spoils something, which in turn implies that there is a consideration to be addressed by ethical theory that is altogether distinct from the experiences themselves. Okay, so what is this extra aspect? Pain blights something. What is this added element? At various stages throughout the history of ethics, theorists have put forward concepts: sanctity, inherent value, intrinsic value, respect, dignity, telos, among others, in response to the intuition that as far as our dealings with animals is concerned, there seems to be more to consider than simply the phenomenological dimension of pleasure and pain. The distinction between the quality of life and its value is sometimes made to reflect this intuition. Quality of life refers to the experiential dimension. Value of life speaks to other non-pain related considerations. Often you hear people register their concern for animals by saying, animals are valuable intrinsically, or that an animal is valuable in itself, or they say an animal has a life that is valuable for its own sake. Such statements are in line with a common sense view that animals are not simply disposable, like so much pieces of furniture. But valuing practices like these seem coherent only if we accept, contra the conventional view, that the harm of death, to borrow an expression from Tom Regan, is not reducible to or commensurate with experiences. And so the conventional view can't explain this kind of talk, this kind of behaviour of people when they respond to what is being done to animals. Now, talk of value often leads to metaphysical questions about the ontological status of this value. Can it be placed in a scientific account of the world? Is inherent value a non-natural property akin to a soul? Is it reducible to a natural property like sentience? While questions such as these may be intuitively interesting, the practical relevance to people's valuing behaviour is unclear, and most likely they only serve to detract from and perhaps even discredit what are perfectly natural reactions to the plight of some animals. I'm thinking here about reactions to certain instances of animal use, say for entertainment purposes, or use in advertising, or cases when animals from free-roaming species, such as elephants or wolves, are confined in small enclosures. Such cases seem problematic, a cause for concern, or prompt feelings of unease, even if the animals involved feel no pain. And these responses are presumably not simply in virtue of what such actions say about the perpetrators. My view is that the use of value talk in response to such cases ought to be seen as an appropriate way of responding, perhaps registering one's objection or disapproval of what is going on. More specifically, it signals that as far as the speaker is concerned, there is more to be taken into account than simply the phenomenological dimension of pain and suffering. Okay? So the idea is that we have these responses in particular cases that the conventional view cannot account for. Cases of confinement, cases when the concept of dignity seems appropriate, when the concept of respect seems appropriate. The conventional view can't explain why people are using such terms. If we can accept the twofold thesis about the badness of pain and what I have just said about people's use of moral terms, then existing pain-focused animal welfare and anti-cruelty legislation and norms can be viewed in a new light. The rationale and implications of the institutions change, and their scope is broadened to cover a range of behaviours and practices. Such institutions would have a deliberative dimension that is reflective of a public concern for pain that extends beyond concern for felt pain to a concern for non-phenomenological considerations, including the life of the sufferer. The explicit institutional objective to ensure animal lives are pain-free could be read as implicit endorsement of the view that their lives also matter, or that they are owed respect, or that they have a dignity, etc. Okay? So this objective that animal lives be pain-free is the goal of this legislation. And what I'm suggesting is that if that's our goal for this legislation, then this says something about their lives over and above whether they're suffering. So there's some objections now to this view that I want to address. Now, an objection is that I've misunderstood the rationale of welfare legislation, and that the only purpose they serve is to protect animals from aversive experiences. And this, in turn, is reflective of community concern, which is also exclusively focused on experiences. This doesn't seem right, as it renders people's concern for pain as fickle, like a tempestuous love affair with affections that come and go, waxing and waning in responses to changes in phenomenology. Okay? So someone might say, yes, we are concerned about animal pain, but we're concerned about the experiences. And I want to suggest this misunderstands what concern for pain is. What do I mean? Think about concern for pain in terms of the balance function on a stereo. If concern for pain is simply concern for experiences, then when an individual is experiencing pleasure, we can conceive a decrease in concern warranting that the dial be turned to the left. Conversely, when an individual experiences pain, we can conceive an increase in concern warranting that the dial be turned to the right. Concern for pain on this conception seems too dynamic and a poor substitute for the everyday concern we have for the pain of those we care about. I care about my wife's pain even when she's experiencing pleasure. In like manner, I want my friend Jason to do well even when things are going well for him. I want my niece to make the most of her education, irrespective of whether her teacher is having a good or a bad day. It's not that such concerns are merely episodic, only appearing on my list of concerns when I become aware of this or that episode of a loved one having an aversive experience and falling away at other times. yes, they may fall out of my conscious awareness, but this is different to saying that they are not part of my set of ongoing concerns. What is required then is a conception of concern for pain that is an analogue for locating the dial at zero, or at a neutral point between equidistant between pleasure and pain. And what I want to suggest is that a concern for life, or more specifically, a concern for considerations other than simply aversive experiences, fits the bill. Now, some might argue that by paying so much attention to concern for pain, I'm straying too far away from capacities. On this view, whether animals have an interest in continuing to live is a descriptive question to be determined with reference to empirical evidence. And affording too much importance to concern for pain opens the door to relativism. But the relativism accusation is misplaced because the concern is closely allied, the concern for these other considerations, say a concern for life, is closely allied with concern for pain. And sentience has been recognised by abstract universal ethical theories as morally significant since at least the 18th century. So insofar as ordinary valuing practices and associated institutions are sentience focused, and they are, then psychological capacities will serve to restrain the influence of inappropriate concern. See, somebody might say, well, what if people are concerned about the pain of an armchair or a vase or something like that? Surely there must be some scope or some role for the science to play. And this is why I'm talking about concern for pain rather than just simply concern for animals. Another objection is that the twofold thesis about the badness of pain is only applicable to animals, human or non-human, with the capacity for higher order thought, that is, persons. But higher order thoughts are not needed to make sense of the common sense view of animal lives. The basic notion of a pain-free life, valuable for its own sake, follows naturally from the idea that animals are not disposable, and the uncontroversial institutional goal of making their lives pain-free. In fact, given the prevalence of pain-related norms around the world, higher-order thought autonomy does not enter into ordinary judgments about the harm of death. A final objection is that there are better ways to gauge community concern for animal pain than valuing practices and associated institutions, namely people's consumer behaviour, especially their dietary behaviour. So someone might say, okay, yes, people are concerned about animals or they exhibit a particular kind of behaviour, but I'm picking out the wrong behaviour. It's not the usage of moral terms that matters. It's not the institutions that matter. They vote with their stomachs, so to speak, through their diets. But intuitively, people's consumer behaviour seems too unreflective and too likely the product of custom and habit to be a reliable gauge of their valuing practices. In contrast, institutions and norms are initiated after a political or policy process in which a range of views are considered. Such a process opens an ameliorative window in an animal protection system that is otherwise constrained by our liberal democratic inheritance and the almost omnipresent use of animals for our purposes. So there is some authority to be gleaned from these, from the time it takes and the kind of political process it takes to establish these institutions. And that is a sound basis for gauging concern. If we accept the... So let me turn now to confinement. But before I do, so that's the idea. We're concerned about pain. There's a twofold. Pain is bad for two reasons. So we're concerned about pain for two reasons. We need a non-phenomenological account of that concern. It's the idea that we're concerned irrespective of the experiences. So let me turn now to confinement. I turn now to the question of animal confinement, specifically whether constraining animals is bad for them, even if they do not suffer. In other words, is physically constraining animals intrinsically bad for them, or harmful independent of any pleasurable or aversive phenomenology? In a recent paper, Alistair Cochrane argues that animals do not have an intrinsic interest in liberty because they lack the requisite mental states that would make confining them a deprivation in the relevant sense. Just as animals purportedly lack a concept of the future, and so death does not constitute harm for them, so they also lack a concept of freedom and other related concepts that would make confinement itself a deprivation. We can see that Cochrane's position is of a piece with the conventional view about the harm of death, insofar as what settles the question for him is possession, or strictly speaking, evidence for possession of particular mental states. So Cochrane has the same view about death. He imports that view into confinement. Confinement is harmful if there is suffering, but confinement in benign conditions doesn't constitute a harm. So why this is relevant is that there is a new field from genetic modification of disenhanced animals. So animals who have the capacity for suffering and for particular welfare diseases, to have that capacity bred out of them. So proponents of the conventional view think this is a really good thing, that you can have your factory farming, you can have your status quo, because there won't be the suffering associated with it. So this is the kind of case that makes the question of confinement in itself important. Cochrane, however, by addressing the issue of confinement in such a descriptive way, overlooks how terms such as interests and intrinsic have an expressive, not to say rhetorical, function in real-world debates in which the lives of animals are at stake. In ethics, applied ethics especially, intrinsic is a morally loaded term. It connotes that the interests concerned have a high moral significance and ought to be given significant moral weight in ethical deliberation and public policy. When applied to particular individuals deemed to have moral significance, intrinsic speaks to the comparative moral status of the individuals themselves. The individuals who have intrinsic interests are generally regarded as more important or valuable than the individuals who have merely instrumental interests. Such terms resonate with people and can provide the psychological impetus required to provoke moral sentiments and initiate behavioural change. So what can concern for pain tell us about the harm of confinement? Recall the thesis above is that concern for pain manifests at the personal level in the use of moral terms, which points to acceptance of the idea that pain matters, not simply in virtue of how it feels. More specifically, I suggested the use of certain term reflects a judgment that there is more to consider than simply how pain feels. A similar vocabulary, however, in some cases the very same terms, can be readily employed to register objection to confining animals. Neo-Aristotelian theorists such as Bernie Rowland and Martha Nussbaum, for example, oppose confinement because it violates an animal's telos, or dignity. An alternative position from neo-Kantian theorists like Julian Franklin or Tom Regan is that confinement is bad because it fails to extend to animals the respect they are owed as bearers of inherent value. Now, it is true that if we understand the use of such vocabulary in realist terms, then an equivocation problem arises. The pejorative force of any charge of failing to respect an individual or depriving an individual of their dignity, and the normative significance of each of the ways in which an agent can fail to show respect, seems logically tied to personhood. It is one thing to treat a person merely as a means, it is quite another to treat a non-person in that way. But if we were to understand such terms as simply the registering of objection to confining animals, then no equivocation problem arises. Right? So I think these theorists are right in that. Well, I think it's appropriate that people use terms like dignity or respect or slavery, whatever, in the in debates about how animals are treated. But I think I would disagree with them in that sense, that such terminology is making claims about the world that is true or false. Rather, I see the use of such terms as merely expressions of people's opposition. The second route via which concern for pain can help to inform thinking about confinement is at the institutional level, consisting in animal protection, legislation and norms. The guiding rationale of such institutions is the idea of animals leading a pain-free life, which I suggested earlier implies a widespread recognition that there are considerations other than simply how pain feels that the legislation ought to be directed towards. There is no reason why confinement cannot be one such consideration. For example, it could be argued that confining animals goes against the spirit of the judgment that their lives matter over and above how pain feels, in the same way that a particular action may be legal, yet go against the founding spirit of a piece of legislation. So how might that work? Well, when we envisage the kind of life for animals that is presupposed or constitutes a background condition of the original judgment that their lives are worthy of protection in legislation and norm, one thing seems reasonably clear. Just as a widespread concern for animal pain is not conditional upon particular housing conditions, and what matters is whether they have the capacity to feel pain, likewise the judgment that their lives matter over and above how pain feels is not qualified with any concept of confinement in mind. What matters is that there is something to be blighted by the pain. The default picture of the animal, therefore, that is a background condition of the judgment that their lives matter, is one of a free-roaming animal, or at least a picture of the animal that does not depict them in conditions of confinement. And any particular instances of confinement worthy of moral evaluation will be congruent or incongruent with a picture of a free-roaming animal. So while it may be the case that the kind of public concern that history has shown gives rise to animal-related legislation is simply the registering of a general disapproval towards the mistreatment of animals, it is arguably undemocratic to interpret and then manage this concern as if it is focused exclusively on aversive experiences. Indeed, doing so fails to reflect its distinctly lay or folk character. It is unlikely that people split hairs between pain and life when it comes to concern for animals. If welfare legislation was viewed as reflecting a public concern to protect animals in a broader sense, then it would apply as much to the questions of painless killing and confinement as it does to the issue of how pain feels on the inside. That's it.